SF Signal Episode 15, World Fantasy Convention 2010 Recap, and our interview with Kevin J. Anderson. This is the SF Signal podcast, episode number 15. This week, at least four of us went to the World Fantasy Convention, so we're going to tell you a little bit about our adventures there. Let me go ahead and introduce everybody. First off, Karen Burnham.
Hi, I'm Karen Burnham. I blog at, well, actually, I guess I realized over the course of this con, I live at this weird intersection. SF Signal, Strange Horizons, and Salon Futura, and a little bit of Locust Magazine. So that's where I live when I'm not
Spiral
living
Galaxy.
At NASA.
And yes, Spiral Galaxy. And that voice you heard talking over Karen was Mr. John DiNardo.
Howdy, folks. John D. here from SF Signal.
And last but certainly not least, my partner in crime, Mr. John Anelio.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. You can get a lot of my songs for free over at johnanelio.bandcamp.com. You can follow me at twitter.com/johnanelio, and I do a video blog for wired.com's Geek Dad blog.
And this week we're going to talk a little bit about World Fantasy 2010, which was held Halloween weekend in Columbus, Ohio. And we all have stories to tell. Who wants to go first?
Well, I'll go first because I want to say about meeting Patrick and John for the first time. Now, obviously, I've known both of these guys online for quite some time, and they both got to the con before I did. And so I got into the hotel on Friday afternoon, and I called Patrick to, you know, to tell him I was in the lobby, and so he can let me into the room. And when I saw Patrick and John come down the stairs, it was a very surreal moment, and I've had these experiences meeting people that I know online in person for the first time, but I think it was really exacerbated that you two guys were together because Patrick is a very big man. He's quite tall and just kind of a big guy, and DiNardo is more like my size.
Or not.
So... Yeah, so when you guys sort of came down the escalator and started coming towards me, it was, you guys looked like cartoons to me. You didn't even like, it was like, it took me a while to sort of like, you know, adjust to your voices coming out of the bodies that I saw. You know, I'm like, what? Like, I've seen pictures of you guys and everything, and, you know, obviously I've been hearing you guys for a long time, but yeah, so that was my initial reaction to going to the con this weekend.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, on atfmb.com and on other things, you know, I always have the pictures of myself with the hat, and that's what I tell people is that's my mountain hat. When I go up to the mountains and do stuff, you know, I tend to wear that hat because it keeps me warm and it keeps the snow off of me. But I don't wear it every day. But I went ahead and wore it the first day of the convention, and it was kind of funny because people could pick me out because I am tall, and they could pick me out of the crowd by going, oh, there's the hat over there, you know. So I thought that was kind of funny. And Karen, you said something, or no, was it John? You said that, like, the second day I didn't wear the hat and you couldn't find me in the crowd.
Yeah, I was looking for the telltale hat, right? Because, you know, you lose people in the crowd or whatever. I'm like, tall guy in hat. Oh, wait, he doesn't have the hat today. And he was, I think you were sitting somewhere, you were walking towards me or something, and I had to do a double take because I wasn't quite sure it was you. Because, you know, your eyes and forehead weren't in shadow. So, like, I wasn't sure.
And, now, yeah, I felt like a giant. I really
yeah,
did.
Yeah, you were definitely one of the bigger dudes walking around there. And let's talk about that. Let's talk a little bit about World Fantasy. I think out of all four of us, I think, Karen, you're the one that's probably been to the most cons. And what can you tell us about World Fantasy and this particular World Fantasy as it compares to other cons?
Compare and contrast. Oh, wait, sorry. I was back in English class for a minute there. Yeah.
And we also need you to diagram the sentence.
Let's see. So this was my second World Fantasy. And, you know, I'm just thinking back because I started going to World Science Fiction conventions back in 2002. And back then, I wasn't even reviewing. I was just a reader. I was just a fan. My husband and I would go, and we'd go to the panels, and it wasn't really a social thing for us. We never kind of found our niche. We'd go, and we'd like have little conversations with people, but we never really found anybody to talk to or bond to, and we usually ended up having dinner alone, that kind of thing. The year that started to change was 2006. I had gotten my tattoos and also worked up the nerve to introduce myself to Charles Brown and Gary K. Wolf. And ever since then, I feel like I've always had friends and interesting people to talk to. And the thing that made me think about the tattoos, Patrick, is you talking about the hat and how identifiable it is.
Right.
I was a little worried because I got into This World Fantasy on Thursday night, and it was kind of cold, so I was wearing my sweatshirt, even in the hotel. And there was part of me that was seriously thinking, oh, but what if no one recognizes me because my tattoos are covered? And I was like reintroducing myself to people just in case, because I also hadn't picked up my name badge yet. And literally people were like, oh, come on, Karen, we know it's you. It's okay.
Well, Karen, you know, that's why I walk around with my guitar strapped to my back the whole time, a la Antonio Banderas.
Yeah, right. You know, I suggested at one point that you should go get your guitar and just like set up in the bar and play. And you, I think you just walked away. You didn't want to hear it.
Yeah, well, funny enough, like as much as I do this stuff online, I kind of hate when people kind of throw whatever they're working on in your face. Like I hate that. Like as you would think that wouldn't be the case considering like I put all this stuff up online for everyone to hear. But I kind of feel like people still have to make the choice to come to me. I don't like that like throwing myself at people. So that I would have never done that.
You so should have played up the Wandering Minstrel. That would have been so cool.
maybe another con. Maybe.
And this would have been the con for that.
I was about to say, that's more of like totally you could get a crowd of people at a Worldcon who were down with that. Uh-huh. But World Fantasy, you might have queered out the bar.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Well, here's the interesting thing. You know, if you're shy, if you feel uncomfortable when you go into large crowds of people that you don't know, just do what I do. Have John DiNardo with you.
Yeah, seriously, con going god over there.
Oh my god, you know who that is over there? Come on, let's go talk to him.
I was freaking out a lot because it's like, you know, somebody would walk, and I don't know what a lot of these folks look like, but I've been, you know, communicating with them via email for years, some of them. And so when they'd pass by, I'd stop and introduce myself. I mean, just if nothing else, to thank them for participating in the mind melds or contributing to the blog or just answering an email, right? That kind of thing. So it was more of a concentrated effort to extend thanks. And yeah, sometimes that blossomed into a conversation or two. But yeah, I was freaking out with all the big names.
I was gonna say, every time. I think we need to step back and just kind of tell people that I've been to a couple of cons now, and just the sheer density of like big name authors that were there was just astounding. I mean, I mean, we're kind of making fun of John for like running up to all these people and talking to them, but you couldn't help but do that because it's, you know, you would talk to one person, then you would turn and walk five steps and bump into John Scalzi or Tobias Bekel or all these people that you kind of know online a little bit through the blogs and what have you, or reading their books. And it's just, it was amazing. I mean, I don't know. It was definitely the most enjoyable con that I've been to so far, just to be able to see and kind of interact with all those folks.
I'm still proud of the fact that we outlasted Scalzi.
We closed the bar and then some.
Yes, and we watched as he made the walk to the elevator. We win! Yeah!
You know, one thing that surprised me about the con was, I honestly, I've only been to a few of them here and only in the local Houston area. And all the cons I've been to have had some sort of fan-based programming track with, you know, fan films or rather, you know, film showings and gaming rooms and things like that. World Fantasy Con is a literary con, and there was none of that. I was fully expecting to see people in costumes. I mean, it not only was it a convention, it was on Halloween weekend. Come on. I would have bet money on it, and I would have lost because it was totally not – nobody was in costume except, I think, a couple of the bellhops on
– There was that one couple that was walking around with the capes on.
Yeah, I guess. I don't remember that.
I think that was about it.
Yeah. But it was really all, you know, literary, you know, focus. So a lot of book people, which I thought was really cool because I kind of prefer my sci-fi in book form.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, when we talk about it, there were the panels, just to give some people some structure on what was going on. You had panels every hour. You had lots of different subjects to choose from, you know, so you're probably going to find something that interested you if you were into that kind of stuff.
Let's talk about the panel. Let's talk about the panels.
Sure.
Let's talk. So I only attended three of them. And I'll explain why later, but in a little bit. But let's talk about Karen's panel, or she was the one that I saw her on. I think she was on at least another one.
Actually, one thing I did want to mention that's nice about World Fantasy as a participant, because it's the membership is capped at, I believe, either 950 or 1,000 people.
I thought it was 2,000.
No, 1,000. It is more than 1,000. Okay. Pretty much the rule, and also they only have two panel tracks and one reading track. No one gets overscheduled. You actually, it is pretty much one person, one panel, no more. So I actually got on one panel this year, which is like, woot.
I thought there was a 10 o'clock panel you also did.
No, I was in the audience, maybe.
Oh, okay. That's what I was thinking of. But the panel you were on was the critical theory panel.
Critical theory and its discontents, in which we all totally refused to get into anything resembling a flame war, and we all pretty much lit.
And here's the description. What is theoretical criticism for? Is literature written to theory, or is theory retrospective and descriptive only? Which is cause and which is effect?
And yeah, that's how what would made you me feel start stupid. With that? The one thing I think we established is that authors don't write as to literary theories or write from literary theories. But then we got into this interesting bit where when authors respond to each other, they are engaging in acts of criticism, which could be theoretical. It was all very confusing.
Oh, for you too?
So no, I actually learned quite a bit listening to Gary and Callie and Farah and Carrie Sparing talking during that panel.
And there was who were the two ladies in the audience?
Farah Mendelson and Carrie Sparing, and both of them, I believe, teach. Farah teaches both literature and history, and Carrie Sparing, I believe, also has a background in history, and her first novel came out last year, Living with Ghosts.
And see, the topic already had me feeling kind of stupid, and then they started talking, and they have British accents, which automatically makes everything sound smarter.
Oh, absolutely. Although there was a very gratifying moment when Gary Wolf was acting as moderator. He handed the microphone over to me for, everybody introduce themselves. And I started out with, I should not be on this panel because I have no background in English. My degrees are in a bachelor's degree in physics and a master's in electrical engineering. And there was like this gasp from the crowd. People went,
I thought it was fascinating because, you know, growing up, I never knew that there was that critical review was such a, I mean, it's a field of study. Right. I mean, and there are classes on this stuff now. I mean, I guess there might have been when I went to school, but I wasn't paying attention hard enough. But I just find it fascinating. I thought it was a fascinating panel. Thought it was very good.
Here's what I don't understand, Karen. And since you've been to a lot of these in the past, maybe you can help me out a little bit. Why do they have panels before 2 p.m.?
Well, we're just lucky they don't start until 10. Some cons actually expect the panelists to show up at 8 in the morning, and we all want to shoot those people. But the downside is I went to a panel at 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, wow.
Which, again, nobody really wanted to be there.
Now, John, you and I went to the panel on Unknown Worlds magazine.
Yes, that was almost right off the plane for me. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty cool one. That had David Drake, Resnick, Jacob Weissman, David Hartwell, and James Aang talking about that magazine and actually telling a ton of different kinds of stories of, you know, this publisher did this or that publisher did that or this magazine was this and pay. And I mean, it was really interesting for me.
Yeah, I think a lot of, I think, well, I always wonder how much the average fan is interested in that. Or knows about that stuff. I think they would be interested in that if they sought that information out. Because I go to those panels and I'm just fascinated with the stories and the history and the things those folks remember, right? Or that they know what's trivia to us is fascinating stuff. And I really enjoyed that panel as well.
Now we're talking a lot about the panels, but I mean, it felt to me like the panels were a small part of the con. I don't even think Anelia went to a single panel.
I did not. I did not attend one panel. And that wasn't like me just trying to like, you know, diss the panels. I didn't get there until midday on Friday. And by the time I sort of got myself all settled on Friday, I had already missed most of them. And then Saturday, just pretty busy. I'd set up a bunch of interviews and banked like three interviews that afternoon. And then I had the Rigor Immortis performance. And then we went out to dinner with Resnick. So my whole Saturday was pretty much booked. So I didn't have time for a panel. But, you know, from talking to a few people there, it seems that the panels are almost secondary to everybody just kind of getting together and hanging out. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and that seems to be the flavor of World Fantasy to begin with. You know, everyone I talked to sort of felt that way. And that's been my, you know, limited experience with cons. This was the fourth one that I've been to in the past year. And, you know, I was telling Patrick while we were at the con, my first con was PhilCon last year, which is coming up again pretty soon. And for that one, I went to, like, I didn't have a minute where I didn't go to a panel. I was like, I paid for this. I'm going to go to every panel. And the panels at PhilCon were actually quite good. But I've sort of, you know, gotten less and less panels because what I've realized is the benefit that I get out of going to these cons is just meeting people and talking to people that I kind of have some sort of association with online, whether I'm a Twitter friend or we've had them on one of the podcasts or something. I'd rather spend that time getting to know them a little more. I think sort of putting a face with a name or a face with a voice is really what it's worth for me. Now, you know, that being said, if there's a really interesting panel, I'm going to go to it. But I think this particular con was really sort of suited to hanging out. And, you know, the bar at this particular hotel was awesome because it was so wide open and big that I think everybody that was in the hotel that was at the con, that bar fit everybody, you know? So, or it seemed that way at least anyway. So it really was like one big party the whole time. And it was great because, especially when you have sort of, and I'll speak for myself, although I imagine you guys might throw yourself in the same category as me, when you have like sort of what I would consider, you know, a pretty small fish like myself in this world. And then you have folks like, you know, the aforementioned John Scalzi there, you know, you don't want to just, you know, sometimes if you're in like a smaller hotel bar or something, it feels a little awkward, like rushing up to him. Like you really feel like you're, you know, kind of getting in someone's face. And I don't like doing that. Whereas this bar was so big and open that, you know, conversations just sort of bled into each other from one to the other. So you sort of got a chance to like literally rub elbows with people and, you know, kind of chat up someone that maybe you would be a little shy to do it otherwise. So I loved that about this hotel and that hotel bar.
Well, and it was flattering that some people knew who we were too. You know, everybody knew John DiNardo.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not true.
No, seriously. Every time I would turn to somebody I knew and go, "Have you met John DiNardo?" They'd be like, "Oh yeah, we just talked to him a few hours ago. Hey, good to see you again." I was like, "Dude." But well, by the way, John, I do want to just commend you on your memory. I mean, how do you remember all these people with the mind melds and who's been on mind melds, who's been a guest vlogger, who's been, you know, contacted but had to say no? Oh my God, do you have a database in your head?
And you don't need a lot of seafood.
No, it's just, you know, it's just email contacts. You remember folks. I mean, I'm sure I forgot some folks. And in fact, I didn't, I mean, there were people there I didn't even learn were there until later, that I wish I had gone to see, or I wish I had gotten to see. So, you know, as much as I was going up to folks, I still missed people. I didn't see them at all. kind of a bummer. I was there.
And I, DiNardo and I, you know, were kind of hanging out for a while on Saturday, sort of in the early evening. And there was, it's a real testament to the, you know, sort of the profile and the quality of SF Signal that I would say about three people that we bumped into. And when DiNardo introduced himself, I think the two people in a row had the exact same reaction, which was, and one was Tobias Bakel, was, oh yeah, SF Signal, you know, I used to subscribe to all these blogs and, you know, I had to cut back and, you know, SF Signal is one of the only ones I kept because, you know, you guys have all the good stuff on it. So,
sweet.
You know, yeah, nice it was, endorsement. Yeah, it was. And seriously, like three people in a row that we bumped into said that to John. So, you know, congratulations, John. I think you know, it goes without saying. And like, I think this is a little time that we can sort of pat you on the back about this, that like, you know, I think your SF Signal is one of the, you know, it's one of the premier blogs for this. And I think specifically for the literary community. So it's not surprising that all the people that are in the literary community were so high on SF Signal. So, you know, congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. I must say, too, the size of my ego knew no bounds that weekend. I almost wish I had my buddies from work to pop that for me every now and then, deflate me a little bit.
That is the only downside, isn't it?
What's that?
The only downside is coming back, and then you're like, hey, I just spent the weekend hanging out with all these famous people. And your coworkers will be like, anyone we've heard of? And I'll always start with, yeah, Peter Straub. And if they look at me with blank stares, I'm like, okay, no one else.
Here's the worst part of that, Karen. You come back to work and you're all excited and you're all jazzed and you're, man, yeah, I had a great time. And your coworker's like, yeah, do you have that spreadsheet that I...
Oh, that's exactly what I got when I got back yesterday. Yeah.
Anyway, about those TPS reports.
Do you have the cover letter? Did you get the memo?
Well, the experience I have with my job, as you know, is that I keep my work life and this life pretty separate. So, like, people ask me what I did over the weekend. It was like, nothing. So it's like I can't even say anything. So, I'm just like, nah.
Dude, you're like Clark Kent.
I am. Yeah, I totally am. No, if they only knew. But anyway, we had a blast, and I think what we do need to mention is we all had the pleasure of going out to eat with Mike Resnick. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you know who Mike Resnick is, but he's written, you know, I don't know, hundreds of books, I'm sure. Who knows how many it is? It's got to be hundreds at this point. And we had the opportunity to go out to eat with he and his wife, Carol. And they are just the most delightful people that you could ever meet. Super nice. Mike had a million great stories. None of which we can tell.
Yeah.
He started every story with, this does not go on the podcast. So we have to respect him and not tell any of those stories, but they were awesome and they were just lovely people and
he wants to know if we're coming to renovation or the science fiction one in Reno now.
The WorldCon, World Science Fiction Con in 2011 in Reno, Nevada.
Woo-hoo.
I will definitely be there.
I'm thinking about it.
I'll have to look into it.
Patrick, for you, it's kind of your backyard.
That's not that far, yeah.
Yeah, but one of the things that I think we also saw Mike Resnick do this at the signing, which we should say there was a big author signing. Which was basically every author that was there was in this gigantic ballroom. It must have been 100 authors. I don't know, could have been more than that. And so that was really fun, just kind of bouncing around from one author to the next. But when we went over to talk to Mike Resnick, someone had brought an old, probably from like 1980. Battlestar Galactica novel that he had written.
He did
a media tie-in, and DiNardo asked, like, you wrote a Battlestar Galactica novel? And Resnick's response was essentially, I guess so. You know, he writes so much that I don't even think he remembered. And he said he had never seen the show and like never saw the new show and doesn't.
No, he had finished it as a favor to a friend or something like that. So, or there was some backstory to it, but he remembered it. It was, it was a while, you know, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, but it was really funny to see like that, to see that novel, and just like he didn't know what a Cylon was or something. I don't know. It was really very funny, and you know, just sort of a testament to like how much writing he's done. And when we had him on the Functional Nerds podcast, you know, quite a few months ago, you know, he just spoke a lot about how he just writes. You know, like I mean, I think you know he looks at it as art and all that, but I think he's just like, yeah, I sit down and I write every day.
That massive author signing is where I lost Patrick, and I was like, okay, put it in my mind, look for the tall guy with the hat, the tall guy with the hat. And every time I would scan the room, I'd see someone else that I just had to you know, go up and talk to. It took me forever to find him again because I'd take two steps and bump into someone. It was like, oh, there's Daryl Gregory, there's Brenda Cooper, there were just so many people. It was just unbelievable. Yeah.
And then there was the long line for
Mr. Gene Wolfe.
Yes.
Yeah. There were tons of people waiting to get their book signed and shake his hand and tell him hi and all that stuff. So, yeah.
The thing that everybody needs to understand who's listening, and I think that all of us can call a takeaway from this, was that, you know, a huge sense of community going to this convention. You know, you are definitely part of a community, and there are... You know, there were tons of people there. Yes, there was a lot of big names. And if you did it correctly, yes, you could walk up to them and say hello.
Yeah, I think the key with going and talking to these folks is, you know, be respectful. I mean, we have a little, I mean, you know, a lot of people know us from doing the podcast. So we've actually like sort of have some contact with these authors. So I think... In our case, they are a little more inclined to give us a little more time because we've had somewhat of a pre-existing relationship with some of them. But I think even if we didn't, I think they'd be more than happy to talk to you. It's just, you know, treat them like you would treat any person. Like, don't go up to them and bug them, and don't go up to them while they're in the middle of talking to someone else. Just like, you know, be a human being about it. And, you know, and they'd be, you know, I think, you know, especially some of the ones that maybe aren't as popular and well-known, I think most of them are delighted that people are reading their books and they want to hear from you. So, you know, just be cool. And like, they're more than happy to give you a few minutes to talk about, you know, their book or what have you. So.
Well, and you know, there's the moments that you have, like John and I going down for lunch, and he sees an author that he just absolutely loves. He's like, oh, you know, we got to go talk to this guy. And then before you know it, we're having lunch with him.
We're eating lunch with S. Andrew Swan, right? So I was grilling him about the third book and his Apotheosis Space Opera Trilogy, wanting to know when it's coming. I kind of knew it was coming in February, but, you know, trying to make sure everything's on track. Got to have my Space Opera Jones satisfied, right? And I was just talking a little bit about the book and the writing process and some of his other books. And it was just this nice casual lunch, just sitting down, talking with them, and it was a lot of fun.
But what was funny was you constantly telling, you know, me that I need to read the books and everybody else that they need to read these books. And, you know, it eventually came down to, like, he wants you to go to every con with him and just follow him around, telling everybody you need to read his books.
I did put that in the post today, my wrap-up post.
So, yeah, like John said, you know, some people do know us a little bit. And so, you know, we had folks like Blake Charlton saying that we were the internet gurus, which I thought was kind of funny. And then, you know, on the flip side, on the older scale, you had someone like David Drake going, who? What?
To share the love a little bit, there were plenty of other bloggers floating around too, right? So, besides us, right, we had Ian Randall Strock from SF Scope was there. Brent Bowen, who's now with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had a lot of fun with him.
Stephen H. Silver was there. And, of course, Dan Goodman was there, who doesn't want me to call him enthusiastic, but he totally is. And of course...
Little ball of energy.
Yeah, yes. And, of course, Anna Lee Newitz and Charlie Jane Andrews from IO9 were there, and I finally got to meet them, which was cool.
Yeah, I didn't get to meet them.
So, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, it was at one point in the bar, I turned to both of you guys and I just said, doesn't this feel like Twitter in real life? You're just sort of looking around and seeing, like, people's icons, but it's the actual people there. And I really felt like that. Oh, I'm going to reply to this person now or go talk to them maybe. Either way, you know. but it was really, I don't know. You do have a bit of a high because, you know, I normally wouldn't stay up that late, but it was just like, you know, you wanted to get the most out of being there. And it's like, you know, every conversation was, was really interesting and fun and entertaining. At no point did I feel bored, like, oh, I got to get out of this.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, I was thinking of that too. It was like there was, I mean, I could have continued any of those conversations, and there was never a time when I was speaking with someone where I was like, okay, done, got to go. You know, there was never any of that.
Well, there was so one time. Fun. There was one time I was talking to John DiNardo. No, just kidding.
Well, I didn't know it was you. You weren't wearing the hat. I thought you were someone else.
I did have to interject myself into someone's conversation rather rudely because Karen was hogging Amelia Beamer and I didn't get to meet her yet.
Really? Like that could totally have happened. No,
that's when I looked up and I saw you talking to her. I was like, I had a great interview with her. I need to meet her. And so I just kind of walked over.
But again, like you say, because you know me, so, and us. And so that makes it like, oh, hey, yeah, what do you mean I hadn't introduced you? kind of thing.
At one point, I remember being down by the bar area, kind of between the bar and restaurant area. And I just saw an empty seat and I just wanted to take a breather. And I'm like, you know, I'm checking Twitter and stuff and kind of nonsense on my phone. And then I hear someone say, excuse me, is this seat taken? And it's Gardner Dozois, right? And I had briefly, said hello to him the night before. But he's like, oh, Gardner Dozois wants to sit across from me. Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, not taken. Sure, go ahead. And then people started kind of congregating, right? And I'm totally sure it was him and not me that brought these people there. Pretty sure. So I mean, like Walter John Williams was sitting there, and like all these people who I'm going to leave someone out eventually, but it was just this conversation that sprung up out of nothing, and that's kind of how it happens. It's like it's not let's meet by that thing and talk. It's crossing people by the bar in the hallway. You know, stopping for a few moments to talk, and it was just very, very casual. You know, it was actually very party-like, like John said. Mm-hmm. It's like one big continuous party.
Well, one of the things. Go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, one thing I've been telling people recently that I just completely realized was true was that if I had structured my entire life with the aim of being able to have interesting conversations with interesting people about interesting things, I couldn't do much better than where my life is right now. And it's things like the World Fantasy Con, for me also ICFA, the International Conference of Fantastic in the Arts, WorldCon, ReaderCon, that play a really big part of that.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm looking at the time here. We're going to be putting this on with another interview, right? It's like,
talking quite a bit.
Yeah, no, it's we could probably talk for a lot longer, but we should probably wrap it up so we leave some space for the interview that is on this show as well. So,
which is even more perfect because at almost every con I've ever been to, you've had the first half of a great conversation. You're like, I'll catch you next year.
Well, all right. Was any final thoughts on World Fantasy before we wrap up the this portion of the show?
That next year, 2011, same kind of weekend, end of October, in San Diego. Yes.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, brother.
Yeah, I've got family in San Diego, so I may make it to that one. We'll have to see.
Cool. Yeah, and I need any excuse I can get back to California.
Hmm. Very good.
What I want to know is who's the highest bidder for the video that I took in the hotel room? and on that note.
All I'm saying is I'm a heavy sleeper. That's all I'm saying.
All right. I think we're done. So everybody, thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time. Have your own thoughts on the subject? Tell us what they are. Call us at our voicemail line, 720-277-9082. We are joined tonight by Kevin J. Anderson, who is an incredibly prolific writer. Has things in science fiction, in fantasy, hard sci-fi. I mean, you name it, and you name the genre, and he's got something going in there. And I've also got with me tonight Jeff Patterson and Andrew Liptak. Andrew, you said you wanted to mention the 501st.
Mr. Anderson, I wanted to say I'm a member of the 501st. I know that you've been a big sort of proponent of us. You have us come out for your book signings and things. I just wondered if you had any what your thoughts were on the group, or do you still see us coming out for even non-Star Wars books?
Oh, I do, and an awful lot. In fact, my wife, Rebecca Mesta, and I are both honorary members and have been for many years. And I go on lots of book signing tours for different projects, whether it's the Dune books or we're doing some space program stuff right now. And I've just gotten into the habit of posting a notice to the 501st board, and the local garrison usually passes it around. And, you know, it sure makes a whole lot of difference when you have a bunch of troopers in full uniform showing up, and then there's also the Rebel Alliance show up. So when I do a book signing, I usually have to let the bookstore know if the 501st is coming, because a bunch of guys come trucking in with these big cases, and they want to take over the back rooms of the bookstore so that they can change into their full uniforms. And you have to warn the bookstore people that there's going to be stormtroopers and black long johns running around and they're putting their armor on. But it really, you know, a book signing is one of these things that it can be really hit or miss, depending on whether you're on the right time or if the bookstore did any publicity or whatever. And just by bringing the 501sters out, it's a whole lot of fun just having... although sometimes Darth Vader just breathes so loud when you're trying to do a talk in front of an audience. But we've been, obviously, the 501sters have long supported all of my Star Wars projects, and I'm just very thrilled that they come out and support my other stuff, too. In fact, we've got, we're all in the Colorado area here, at least Patrick and I are. I don't know if everybody else is. But we're doing a big book signing at the Colorado Springs Challenger Learning Center, which is all to promote space science education, and the 501sters are coming out for that, I believe, and that's on November 13th, I think. So we're all kinds of good stuff coming up, and I just sometimes I like to hole up and do my editing, and other times I like to be a social person and meet the fans.
Well, you have to find that balance too, obviously.
Well, there are some writers that wrote one book and they spent 25 years promoting it, and other writers just keep writing books and never come out of their offices. I try to be a little bit of both.
Yeah. Now, you play in a lot of different sandboxes. Some of them are your own that you've created. Some of them, you know, like Dune, obviously, Frank Herbert. How do you keep all that straight? I mean, I think I would go a little nuts.
Well, fortunately, at the moment, I'm still working in like three or four different universes. I was going to say there was a time when I was writing the Jedi Academy books and the Young Jedi Knights books, which are, they're both Star Wars, but they're set, I'm sorry, I'm pulling the number out of my head, they're set something like 15 to 20 years apart. So I'm telling these different stories with characters, the same characters, 20 years difference in their lifespan. At the same time, I was writing X-Files books and Star Trek comic books, and so it was a little bit hard keeping not the big stuff straight, but the little stuff, like, okay, is it called a comm link in this universe, or a communicator in this universe, or a comm in this universe? And somehow or other, the fans tend to notice if you get these little details wrong. Like,
yeah, gosh.
So you have to really be immersed into it. And in fact, I had a funny... my first Star Wars book called Jedi Search, there's a little a painting of an Imperial Admiral on the cover. And if you use, like, a microscope, you can look at the rank insignia on the Imperial Admiral's uniform. And the artist, that there are like three red squares and three yellow squares and six blue squares. I'm a geek, too. You can tell this. And if you look at it with a microscope, the artist got, like, the red squares and the yellow squares in the opposite order.
Oh,
and
no.
I had a fan write me this letter that I didn't know anything about Star Wars because the cover artist painted three yellow squares and three red squares. But the funny thing was, in that exact instance, there is a page in the book where I described the Admiral's uniform, where I described the insignia correctly. It's just a stupid little throwaway detail, but I had actually described it correctly, so I wrote back to the fan and said, "Bob, but if you look at page 322, and then she wrote back and went, "Oh, okay, I'm relieved now. You do know everything about Star Wars." So
I'm flashing to Shatner on Saturday Night Live.
Well, but you know, you can't. These are people who really, really, really love whatever universe that they're big fans of, whether it's Star Wars or Star Trek. And of course, I have to love it that much in order to spend so much time working at it. It's not like just a day job where you go in and you don't care what you're doing. This is something that it's your creativity and it's your life, and you have to know details like how does Scully take her coffee and what's the number of the apartment that Mulder goes to, and little things that most readers would read by and they wouldn't know or care less if you got it wrong. But for those couple of people that really do get it, they're the ones that really keep you on your toes. And that's why I will try to be evasive and not describe the insignia of Imperial Admiral uniforms anymore, even though I did get that one right.
That's crazy, though. There have been, we put out on the site on SF Signal. We said if you want to ask Kevin J. Anderson a question, you know, post it here and we'll see what we can do. One of the ones that it seemed like a lot of people kind of were curious about is the way you write, and the fact that, you know, you go hiking and you take a recorder with you and you essentially dictate into the recorder. How does that work for you? I mean, how does that process work?
Why, it works very well, thank you.
Are you an outline kind of author? Are you a discovery author? Do you just kind of go off on a trek and you know, see what happens?
Well, I outline in great detail. The books that I write now, especially the Dune books and the Saga of Seven Suns and the Terra Incognita, those are all, they're like Shogun. They're 700, 800 page books with all kinds of storylines and interacting characters, and this thing on this continent leads to something else on a different continent, and these two ships have to come together at a specific time, and I don't see how you can just have that magically happen as you're writing chapters at random. To me, it's the equivalent of trying to build this gigantic skyscraper without bothering to do a blueprint first. I would feel more comfortable if my architect actually did a blueprint before he started building. But I have everything very carefully outlined, which was really important for the kind of stuff that I write, because if I'm writing with Brian Herbert all these Dune books, he's writing half the chapters, I'm writing half the chapters, we both have to have the same roadmap, or we're not both going to end up in the same place. But in a more practical sense, when I'm doing work for like Lucasfilm or X-Files or DC Comics or something, just by having everything outlined in detail to show people ahead of time gives them a chance to approve it and tell me, yes, this is okay, or no, don't have Captain Picard do that because we don't like it. It's nice to know that before you've written the whole book rather than after it's turned in. So I have everything outlined, and in fact, the Sisterhood of Dune, that's the book that we're working, Brian Herbert and I are doing right now, and I'm doing some editing on it. That's like 90-some chapters in it. And it's each outlined, every chapter has a couple of paragraphs describing what happens in that chapter, which will be 10 written pages long about. So I'll go out on a trail, and I'll have these little, I'll print out the pages that has the couple of paragraphs for chapter 22 and the couple of paragraphs for chapter 26 or whatever, whichever ones are my chapters. And I just did, we have the Colorado Trail that runs through the state. It goes from Denver all the way to Durango. It's about 500 miles long, mm-hmm. and I've done about 380 miles of it now.
Wow.
And I'll go out, and it's about a 15-mile hike on average for each one of these segments, and go out with a whole bunch of notes in my backpack, and I've got my digital recorder, and it's all in my head because I've been thinking about this book for the whole time that I'm writing it. And I'll just go out walking, and I'll think up the sentence, and I will speak it out loud into the digital recorder. I don't really see how that's much different from thinking up a sentence and then moving your fingers across a keyboard to type the words, except I would argue there are fewer steps in speaking a sentence out loud than there are in typing it all down.
Well, as you pointed out before we started recording, I am a functional nerd. I'm curious about the technology involved. I mean, are you wearing a headset as you go, or are you just holding a recorder in your hand?
Well, I'm just holding the recorder in my hands, which is why it's really kind of a bummer to try to do the writing in Colorado winters, because it's just like cold and snowy, and I've got these big, thick gloves on. Well, here's, and I'll go to your inner nerd right now. I, for the longest time, and there's still a big part of me that's very, very much fond of it, I had the microcassette recorder, so little teeny tapes, and you would walk around and click the button and then record it. And they vanished as fast as 8-track tapes vanished as soon as digital recorders came out. But quite honestly, the digital recorders, there are problems with it, because in the microcassette recorder, when you pushed the button, it was an actual analog button that went click and locked on and click when you shut it off. But a digital recorder, it's almost like you touch it and it's recording, you touch it and it's not recording. and they're little teeny buttons about the size of like half of a pencil eraser. And so when you got gloves on and you're trying to hit it, I've had sometimes when I thought I was recording and I didn't actually go on, so I'd talk for 5 minutes before I realized that it's not recording anything. And
that's why you need to get the voice activated ones.
The voice activated ones is fine, except every time the wind blows, it starts recording, or it doesn't come on. Like if I start talking, the voice activated will go, oh, Kevin's starting to talk, so I'm going to start recording now, and it usually cuts off the first word or so in your sentence. And when I have, and then I have somebody transcribe it all, so then all of a sudden there's, well, where does this sentence start? And it's a lot. This is like as esoteric a discussion as any of your listeners. They're all snoozing in the background right now.
No, I don't think they are. I don't think they are.
But here, one last thing about the microcassette or the digital recorder. With the microcassette, it was a little bit nerve-wracking because that cassette, that was it. If you lost that cassette, it was gone. Whereas mm-hmm. the digital recorder, I can just download it and back it up someplace else and email the... My typist is in LA, so I just email the stuff to her, and she emails everything back. So it's a whole lot more efficient that way. I just wish they had buttons that went click on and click off when you're working on it. I also have a closet full of unused micro cassettes that I could bring myself to keep.
Believe it or not, I moved into a new house last November, but I'm just now moving into the basement kind of thing. I had boxes and boxes piled up, and I actually found my microcassette recorder with a ton of tapes. So I'm right there with you.
Go ahead.
Andrew, did you have any questions or?
I had one because one of the big sort of themes from some of the questions the readers was how you play a lot in other people's worlds. How does that compare to stuff like your original fiction or quote unquote original fiction? With your own characters, your own storylines, whereas then you go and jump into somebody else's universe. Is there how do you approach different levels or if there are there any different levels of creativity when you go into those things?
Well, there are different safety nets that you have to work under. If it's something that's of my own creation, like the Terra Incognita books or the Saga of Seven Sons, I make all the stuff up. I've got all the characters. I can do whatever I want in the plot. I don't have to alter a storyline because it doesn't fit with somebody's Micro Machine action figures that they want to come up with or something like that. But on the other hand, I do have to create everything, and I mean everything. I mean all the characters and history and planets and monetary systems and the climates and all of that stuff, whereas say Dune or Star Wars, for instance, there's an entire backlog of things that I can just look at and use it as like an encyclopedia. Encyclopedias were those books on the shelves that you used to use before Wikipedia. Although the stuff that was in encyclopedias was generally verified and accurate, the stuff on Wikipedia depends on which day of the week that you go onto it. But that's a different tangential thing.
Do you have any time for television?
Well, of course, it's my job. I have to watch things like Stargate Universe and Caprica and whatever, because somebody might call and say, Kevin, we want you to write scripts for this. So I have to be able to say why. Of course, that's my favorite show.
I'm just curious.
Shows that I like to watch.
But I'm just curious if you've ever watched Modern Family.
Oh, I love Modern Family. We just laugh and laugh and laugh with Modern Family.
They decided to go offline for a week, and so the one daughter was told to use the encyclopedia to write a report.
Mm-hmm.
And they had changed the name of something from the time when the encyclopedia had been printed from the time that, you know, on the internet. And so she got a B instead of an A, and she was very upset. And it just, when you mentioned the encyclopedia, it reminded me of that because, you know, they were like, no, use the encyclopedia. That's what people did before the internet. And then she gets very pissed off because she's like, the encyclopedia was wrong.
Well, we have a set, and I kept it just because what if I need to check something, and I don't think I've touched it in 12 years. I mean, and as much as I will knock Wikipedia, most of the time if I'm just trying to look up what year was President Taft elected or whatever, Google it, it shows up on Wikipedia or at some entry, and you get the information, and you go away. It used to be a lot harder to do research, and we have become sort of lazy because you go, oh, here's an answer, and they'll just go with it.
I remember begging my mom for a set of encyclopedias.
Well, the
different times.
What I remember is that you'd get the yearbook every year because it's a physical bound book that is no longer up to date a year later, and they would send you this yearbook of these are the articles that are supposed to be updated, and they would you would have a sheet full of little peel and stick stickers that you're supposed to put into the encyclopedia book itself that said there's an updated article about hemorrhoids in the yearbook for those of you who don't remember these sorts of things, it's a heck of a lot easier now to do things like
it
that.
It is. I'd like
to add also there that there's an entire subcategory of joke about encyclopedia salesmen that you can't tell anymore. You know?
Well, and brush salesmen. Nobody buys anything door to door. In fact, my wife is a huge shopper, and she buys all kinds of things, and she never leaves the house. Our UPS guy is so buff because he carries boxes up to our doorstep like six times a day because she's ordered everything. And she even, we had to get a stop to this. She didn't want to leave, so she was ordering groceries online, and people were delivering milk and eggs and stuff.
King
like
Soopers.
That. Yes, King Soopers does it. And just went... So you can actually, this should be great for like the nerds on the podcast. You don't ever have to leave your house. You can play World of Warcraft 24/7 and never even have to go get groceries. It's great.
But. It's crazy. A good follow-up for Andrew's question. Have you ever had just what you thought was the best idea ever for Dune, for Star Wars, for something like that, and you're like, oh, this is going to be the best idea ever, and then someone down the line or up the pipeline or whatever said, no.
Yes, two of those, in fact, and one of it worked and one of it didn't. The one that worked, I had an idea that I wanted to write a big story, kind of like The Last Days of Pompeii, this big, the end of the world kind of story, but about the planet Krypton. Because, you know, these little random snatches of Superman's history, the little Marlon Brando stuff in the movie, and the little things about Brainiac stealing the city of Kandor and shrinking it down and putting it under a dome, and General Zod and his uprising, and Jor-El falling in love with Lara, and Jor-El's smarter brother Zor-El on the Argo Sea, all these little things.
Mm-hmm.
See, I told you I'm a geeky fanboy. But I thought, this is really a cool, you could do this whole Last Days of Krypton story, how the whole planet's falling apart. How did Krypton's planet explode? Why? Planets don't just explode most of the time. That something had to have happened. And if Jor-El was the smartest person on the entire planet, how come nobody believed him when he said that the world was coming to an end? And if this is such an advanced planet, how come they only had one spaceship on the whole planet? And who builds a spaceship that's only baby-sized? You know, little things like that. Well, I thought this would be a great epic science fiction novel. It was one of the best ideas that I ever had. And I was working with DC Comics on some comics. So I was some Justice Society comics, and I was writing them. And I wrote to my comics editor, and I said, I love this idea. I want to write this as... Actually, I think I wanted to do it as a graphic novel or comic series. I want to do this whole story of the Last Days of Krypton, the pulling everything together, make it all make sense. And I got we've done some Superman stuff before. And I just, really? This is one of the best ideas I've ever had. And instead, I got nothing. And then fast forward just a little bit later, it turns out that the president of DC Comics loves my Dune books with Brian Herbert. And he was talking to me all about the Dune books, and I was sending him some signed copies, and he was writing back and forth. And I, just as a conversation, I said, you know, I had this really good idea, and I'd really like to write a book about it, but it didn't really go anywhere. Oh, yeah, what idea is that? So I pitched him The Last Days of Krypton, and he was silent for a second, and he said, that's the best idea I've ever heard. So then from the president on down, there was the command that Kevin was going to write this book. So yes, I had the good idea. It didn't meet with the appropriate enthusiasm when I pitched it in one direction, but then it went in another direction. And the one that didn't work and this will get to the 501sters and stuff out there. I did a book with Ralph McCrory called The Illustrated Star Wars Universe a long time ago, a big coffee table book, which is sort of a like a National Geographic about all the planets in the Star Wars universe.
I remember it, actually.
And I had to write these different articles about Dagobah, about Tatooine, about Bespin, about Endor, all this stuff, doing the telling the background of all the stuff you knew there.
I'm confused, because according to the last three movies, there's really only two planets, Tatooine and Coruscant.
Yes, that's it. And Naboo. But this was all before any of that stuff, and in fact, it's a nice segue, because it was before Jar Jar Binks. And before Jar Jar Binks, the thing that nobody liked was the Ewoks, because they were too silly and too cute.
Yep.
And I wasn't the huge fan of the Ewoks either, but here I am supposed to write an entire section on the ecology and of Endor and the sociology of the Ewoks and what their civilization's like, and they're just cute little roly-poly teddy bears that are sort of feral. So how can I be interested in that? So I sat there and mulled it over a little bit, and then suddenly this, before Krypton, this was the best idea I'd ever had. I thought, well, what if these things were genetically engineered as pets? They were like the equivalent of poodles. These were cute little roly-poly teddy bears that people used to keep as pets on some random planet. And picture like a space yacht with some rich people aboard that had a handful of these pet Ewoks, and their ship crash lands on Endor. The rich people are killed. The Ewoks survive, and the only thing functional on the ship is this golden droid that teaches them how to survive and build tree houses. And I thought, that explains everything, why they worship C-3PO, why they're so stupidly cute. They're cute because they were bred to be cute, but then they're turned loose on this forest planet and they have to make a civilization for themselves. So everything fit together. I could get the Ewoks then. I could swallow that. In fact, I could even go get behind it, because there's a reason for them to be cute now. And it all made such perfect sense. And I was very excited and wrote it all up. And I sent it off to Lucasfilm, and they sent it up to George. And George wrote back, no, the Ewoks are cute because they're cute. That was his answer. They're cute because they're cute. So that great idea never went anywhere. But we know, now all your listeners know, that the real reason why Ewoks are cute is because they were bred that way.
That's awesome. Got a question here from the website that I thought was kind of cool. This is from Mike P. He said, first off, I've always hated sprawling epics with casts of thousands, but I couldn't stop reading Saga of the Seven Sons. Thanks for that. Saga felt like a continuous...
Well, there is a glossary at the end, so I hope it was better.
He said, it felt like a continuous story all the way through. Did you start out with seven books in mind, or did it just kind of get away from you?
No, I had planned from start to finish. I knew exactly how it was going to end, and I knew it was going to take seven books. It's called The Saga of Seven Sons, so that was your first clue. and it was the whole basic story that I had come up with just from start to finish, because I was reading these big fantasy epics, the Terry Goodkinds and Robert Jordans and Terry Brooks, and and I got to thinking, how come there's no gigantic sprawling science fiction epic? Well, there's Dune, which I was co-writing with Brian anyway, the other books in that series, but there was, not that I could think of at least, there was no giant continuing epic with thousands of characters that Mike P. hates. But I planned it from start to finish, not all the details, just the basic events that happened and the big conflicts and who was going to die here and what was going to blow up there. And so I did have it projected all the way through, which is the way I could, I'm really bad at keeping secrets. So when I know some big plot twist coming up, it's very hard for me to not reveal it too soon. But if I had the whole seven books outlined, I could go, no, we don't know this until book four. There's one character who sort of disappears at the end of book one. One of the very important and popular characters that disappears at the end of book one, and we don't see the character again until, I think, the end of book four, maybe even book five. There's a couple of hints here and there throughout the book, but boy, I had to stretch that out for a long time, because I knew exactly when the character had to come back. But yes, I did plan the whole thing, and now I can see that my answer is getting up to 700 pages long too. So
that's okay.
I'll stop there.
Follow up from Jeff K. Do you ever plan to write more novels which take place in the Saga of Seven Sons universe?
Why, I didn't even pay him to say that. But yes, I am writing up an outline and a proposal for, I think it'll be three books right now. I'm still outlining the whole story, but I got the big events in my mind, and I'm calling it the Saga of Shadows, and it'll be probably 20 years after the end of the other Saga of Seven Sons books. So it's the same universe. There will be some characters coming back. There will be a whole new generation of characters that are in it. And the reason I'm doing that is to make it so that, A, I don't want to have book 10 of the seven-book series. I don't think that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to have it standalone enough that if this is the one you picked up and read, then you would get it and get into the universe as a new entry point. But the people who liked the first seven books would pick it up and feel right at home. It's very much like what Brian and I are doing in the Dune books. We did a trilogy of the Butlerian Jihad time frame. We did a trilogy that was an immediate prequel to the novel Dune itself. We did two sequels far at the end of the time period after Frank Herbert's last books. So each one of those, you can pick them up and read it. It's not like I've read the first of the Robert Jordan books, but I'm just intimidated that I'm seeing 11 more books to read. So it's keeping me from reading the rest of them. But if I know it's only a trilogy, and if I like it, there are more trilogies, then that's a better way to keep readers going. But
sure.
I'm finishing up. I'm doing the final tweak edits on the third and last book in my Terra Incognita trilogy, which is all about sailing ships and sea monsters. And and after 3 years of doing those, then I'm about ready to go back into the Seven Sons universe.
I want to throw a Dune question at you. This one's from Richard Romali. He said, I started reading Dune books 2 years ago after we did a sci-fi as literature unit in my English class. As an Arab American, I really identified with the Fremen and their culture. So I was glad when you and Mr. Herbert returned to the Fremen times in Paul of Dune and Winds of Dune. Here's his question. Will we ever learn more about the Madru and their relationship to the Fremen?
Probably not.
Dang.
How's that for an answer? No, there are hints and stuff through it, but one of the things that Brian and I discussed in great detail is that Frank Herbert created this universe, and he intentionally put stuff in there that nobody's ever going to get the answer to. That all of the, like, where did the sandworms come from, and where does the where does old Earth fit? Well, that's in some of the books, but there are a lot of little questions, and where did some of these people come from? Where did their beliefs come from? That it's clear he added in there that he didn't want anybody to explain it. And there are some parts, like in Children of Dune, it's I believe that's the one it's in, he hints very clearly that the sandworms were brought to the planet Dune from someplace else by someone else. And that's like, whoa, that's pretty interesting, but there's no other information about it.
Mm.
We'll be putting a few more details here and there, but we are not going to have somebody discover some chest and open it up and there's a tablet inside that explains, like, the Wikipedia entry of the Muadru. Not going to do that.
Gotcha. I'm going to go with one more here. Paul asks, how do you feel about switching between hard epic science fiction and, in your latest series, fantasy? What challenges have you faced in switching gears?
Well, one of the fun... I've got a physics major, a physics degree, an astronomy degree, and I've grown up in science and reading hard science fiction, but I also read a lot of fantasy. My minor in college was Russian history, and I took Japanese history and history of medicine and all kinds of things. So I was sort of one foot in each fantasy and science fiction. And I know a lot of science fiction authors, but I've known Jerry Purnell for quite a long time. And Jerry Purnell was going on and on in this talk with me and some other authors who were next to him about how science fiction was hard, but fantasy was just a breeze because you could just snap your fingers and make up a spell for this or that. And being a science fiction guy, I kind of sat back and nodded a little bit, but I enjoyed fantasy anyway. But my Terra Incognita series is all about sailing ships and sea monsters and cartography and creating the new maps of the world and a clash of religions. And there was all kinds of stuff in it that I had to deal with that don't come up in a science fiction novel. Like when you're on a sailing ship, or how do the ropes all fit together, and how does somebody, how do you sail against the wind, or what, and do they actually have varnish, or do they have, they don't have polyester clothes, I presume, but what do they have, and how do they make this, and do they have this, it was on book three of Terra Incognita, I'm writing this, all of a sudden, I stopped and scratched my head, and I thought, do they have the printing press yet or not? Because that had never come up before. And in a science fiction book, you can make something like that up. If I don't know what material their shirts are made out of in a Star Trek universe, well, I'll make up some fiber from some planet, and that's the answer. But if you're back in the Age of Discovery and Prince Henry the Navigator and somebody's wearing a shirt, is it a shirt made of linen? Is it a shirt made of wool? Or is it a shirt made of cotton? There's a real answer to that. That it's not as, you don't have to do as much time with the rigorous science part, but there are all kinds of other questions that you do have to deal with. Now, if it's sort of a throwaway fantasy when you've got people running around what looks like the English countryside and they've got pointed ears and the dwarves all have axes and you have ogres and people are picking up a spell book and making up spells, you can sort of make that stuff up. But if you're doing something that is an interesting and innovative world, I mean, I'm certainly interested in the Dungeons and Dragons kind of stuff, so it's not that that's not interesting, but I think that might be a section we want to cut out.
you're fine.
Anyway, the answer being, there are a lot of questions in fantasy that you have to find the answer to, just like in science fiction. And what I like is the story. To me, it's the story about exploring a planet with unknown continents, or exploring a portion of the galaxy with unknown solar systems. And
gotcha.
Whether I have an alien race called the Ildirans, or whether I have a race like the elves, in my mind, it's the same story components, and I want to tell the big stories.
Gotcha. Hey, Jeff, you had a question about Terra Incognita, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I'm enjoying them, and I'm very much enjoying the Roswell 6 albums that have come out along with them. And my question was, to what extent in the creative process does one influence the other? When you're writing the book, are you actually thinking about the over-the-top prog metal album that's going to be accompanying it?
Well, it was in a lot of the cases we were planning. Let me back up and explain just a little bit. For the first two books in the Terra Incognita series, we did a companion, like a rock opera. It's not really a soundtrack, it's sort of a companion rock CD with it. And we had some of my favorite musicians performing on them. We had Steve Walsh from Kansas, the guy that sang Carry On Wayward Son and Dust in the Wind. And we had John Payne from Asia, and we had James LaBrie from Dream Theater, and a lot of people that are just, they're all over my CD rack, that I've listened to them for a long time. And we wrote the lyrics for the songs that tell one of the storylines from the novel. But we were writing the lyrics, my wife and I were writing the lyrics for the songs as I was doing the writing for the novel, so that I knew which scenes were going to be songs. And I could feed back on that. When I got one of the songs written, I could make sure that those some of the lyrics found their way back hidden into the text there, so that if you're a fan of the Roswell 6 CDs and you read the book, there are going to be phrases that will pop out at you that other people won't even notice because they're the chorus of a song or something like that. One of the key things in the first book, The Edge of the World, was from a song title that we came up with. We were sitting in a restaurant, I think it was the Cheesecake Factory in Boulder, Colorado. We were sitting there just throwing some things back and forth. And I came up with this line that was, when you reach the edge of the world, you can fly. because all of this is about people sailing. They're afraid they're going to sail off the edge of the world, and they're looking for new places, and they're going to discover new continents. But that line, when you reach the edge of the world, you can fly, was just so struck me that we used it in, I think, three of the tracks on the CD, and that's the epigraph for the novel, The Edge of the World, and I think it's fed through appearing one or two times in the text itself. So we go back and forth, and in fact, it was just tonight, the owner of the record label and Henning Pauly, the guy who wrote all of our music for the second CD, they're pressuring me whether we can get the third CD out in time for the third book, or if we have to wait for the paperback of it. And I'm just so swamped with other projects. I'm not certain that I can get the next. We'll do another one. I'm just not certain I can get it out in time for the next book, which is next June. But I'm really geeking out as a fanboy because I get to be corresponding with these rock stars that I've adored for ages. And like Dream Theater, we've seen them backstage a couple of times when they come playing through. And I'm corresponding with Steve Walsh, the guy that when I was in high school, I had Carry On Wayward Son. And Point of No Return was the Kansas album. The cover on it has a bunch of sea monsters on it, and there's a ship sailing off the edge of the world. Well, that was the seminal idea of the whole Terra Incognita series, was that album. And so now I've got the guy who sang on that album singing on the CD that's the companion to the book that I wrote that was inspired by that album. Which
that's awesome.
It makes your head kind of spin. But
hey, Andrew, did you have any other questions?
Yeah, one last one, or at least one last one from me. When it comes to Dune, it's a really long franchise. And what has the reaction been from people who've been reading it since the beginning, when Frank Herbert might have written it, and you have a lot of, I'm guessing, a lot of new people reading it? Have you seen a difference in fans for the books, or is what's the story there?
Well, Dune is one of those things that it's amazing the breadth of the fans, that there are some of the real old diehards that read it when it first appeared in Analog magazine in the early 1960s, and then you have an entire batch of people that got head over heels into the Dune universe because of the David Lynch movie, which most of the diehard Dune fans couldn't stand the movie, but there's an entire fan base that loves the movie, and that's what got them into reading the Dune books. There is another different demographic that got into reading the Dune books because they saw the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries that was done a few years ago. And I have, of my Star Wars books, there's something like 4 or 5 million copies of the Star Wars books in print. And I started writing the Dune books after I did all the Star Wars books. And I've gotten bushels of letters from my Star Wars fans saying, okay, I was too intimidated to read Frank Herbert's Dune, but because I like your books, I read all the prequels you wrote with Brian Herbert, which got me up to speed, and then I read the Frank Herbert books, and now I'm reading all the whole series. So there's another group of fans that never would have read Dune, but they came into it because they liked my Star Wars books, and they're reading the whole section. And so it just keeps going, and we do book signings and public appearances all the time. We go around on tours, and just the mix of people in our audience is just incredible. I would assume, and maybe I'm stereotyping here, but I would assume that if Stephanie Meyer does a signing for a new Twilight book, that they're like all teenage girls that are out there in the audience. You can't say that for a Dune book. We've got teenage girls, but we've also got 70-year-old retirees. We have college students, we have 38-year-old professionals, we have this whole range of people that come for it. So Dune is so complex in so many different ways that it attracts different readers for different reasons.
Now, one of the questions on the website was, were we going to be willing to ask you the hard questions? And I'm here to say that we are. So,
oh, goody.
I want to know, if a train is leaving Chicago at 60 miles an hour,
where do they bury the survivors?
Here's, you know, I like to have fun, and I live in Colorado, too. What's your favorite 14er?
Oh, boy. I think Uncompahgre is one of the most beautiful ones, or Sneffels is one of the most beautiful ones. And Sneffels, is very interesting because that was named after the mountain in Jules Verne's book, Journey to the Center of the Earth, in Iceland, where they went through Sneffels to go into the cave to go down to the center of the earth. And when one of the original explorers out in Colorado saw these mountains and was naming them, he was reading Jules Verne's book, and that's why he named the mountain Sneffels.
Wow.
And that's one of the more beautiful Portiners out there. And it just so happened I was reading A Journey to the Center of the Earth while I was out camping in the area, and I climbed the peak then. So that holds a special place for me.
That's awesome. Why is Bojo's in Idaho Springs 10,000 times better than Bojo's in Denver?
I haven't eaten at either one because in Idaho Springs there's the Tommyknockers Brewery, so why would I waste a trip to a pizza place?
Because it's a Colorado pie.
Yeah.
All right.
I will have to try it sometime. But the Idaho Springs one is better. I'll have to go there.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It's the original. It's the original.
All right.
It's not far from the original Coors water wheel.
Yes, I've seen it going through there, but like I said, there's a brewery in town, so why would I go to a pizza place? But that's just my preferences.
They've got all the local beer there.
Okay, well, I'll have to consider that the next time I'm coming through then.
Any follow-up questions?
I just wanted to personal curiosity if there's ever going to be anything else similar to Last Days of Krypton, like Last Days of Mars or something like that, because I really did enjoy that book.
Well, I got the Enemies and Allies that just came out in paperback, which is the first meeting of Batman and Superman, and I said it in the 1950s during the Cold War. So that's not the same epic as The Last Days of Krypton. We've got both of those did very well, and the fans loved them. I've won several awards on each one of those books, but we're throwing some other ideas around. I would like to do the story of Supergirl's origin and Argo City, which also survived the explosion of Krypton, and it's a poignant story. I mean, it's this domed city on a chunk of rock that got blasted away from the planet, and then the rock starts turning into kryptonite, which starts killing all the people aboard, and the only way they can save this one, Zor-El can save his daughter, is by shipping her off to Earth. And for some reason, saying I want to write a novel that the last survivors of a planet all die is just not is exciting to them, I guess. But we've got a couple of other proposals that are in. Right now, DC Comics, their whole publishing line is going through some turmoil right now, so they're kind of holding off and spinning their wheels. But everybody loved the first two that I did, and I sure like doing them because I got a whole bunch of free comics as research in order to write them. But, so it turned out well, and we've got some pitches in, so we'll see. This, for me, I've always got different irons in the fire, so you never know what's going to heat up at what point.
And that's a nice segue. What have you got coming out soon?
Well, the one that we're really very excited about is Brian Herbert and I have written an original novel, not a Dune novel. It's our own big epic called Hellhole, about basically a hellish planet that got struck by an asteroid about 500 years ago and wrecked the ecosystem, killed almost everything on it, but it's just now starting to be colonized, and of course Hellhole is the place to go where you've got nowhere else to go. Nobody wants to pick that as your place to settle, so only the misfits and exiled rebel go there, and religious nuts and all kinds of people that don't have any other place. It's the island of misfit toys is basically what it is, only it's got volcanoes and everything all over the place. That book comes out in February. That's our we've done 12 Dune books together. It's time that we can do something original.
Sure.
So that one
sure.
comes out. Right now, just in time for Halloween, I've edited an anthology called Blood Light, which is a bunch of humorous horror stories by a lot of well-known horror writers. So that's
nice.
That's very fun. It looks. It's a great-looking book, too. It's a smiling vampire with fangs, but she's got braces on her teeth. It's just kind of a cute little image. But we already talked about the Terra Incognita books and the two rock CDs that go along with that. And my wife and I are doing some kids' books with the Challenger Center to promote interest in space education and the space program.
Awesome.
So, I don't know if you can draw any parallels from any of those, but we're...
And then you've also...
do different things.
You've also got the workshop that you wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah. I've got, for those aspiring writers who are listening to the podcast, we have, it's myself and Rebecca, as well as other big best-selling authors, Brandon Sanderson, David Farland, Eric Flint, and Sherilyn Kenyon. All of us are teaching something called the Superstars Writing Seminar, which is a three-day real no-nonsense, nuts and bolts, how to make a career as a writer. It's not a creative writing class. It's a business of writing class. And that takes place for 3 days in Salt Lake City in January. And you can, Superstars Writing Seminars, with an S at the end, so seminars.com. That's the whole website where you can see all the different classes. So I get to do the administration part of that, which is a lot more challenging than making up universes and blowing up planets.
And that actually sounds really cool.
I mean, we did the first one last spring in Pasadena, and that was a huge success, and we're going to keep doing them, I hope, like one a year or so. And it just, nobody teaches stuff like this. These are things that I wish somebody had taught me when I was starting out. So we're, like I said, me and Rebecca, Sherilyn Kenyon has had 14 number one New York Times bestsellers in the last 2 years. That's somebody that you might want to listen to if she's telling you how to be a popular writer. I've had 46 national and international bestsellers, and Brandon Sanderson, he's the guy who's writing the rest of the Robert Jordan series.
Yep.
You know, bam, he just hit number one in the New York Times with his first one that came out, and his original book that's not part of the Jordan series just debuted in, I think, number three on the New York Times. So these are people you might want to listen to. We've got a fair number of credentials, and we're telling you how to, like, read contracts and read royalty statements and how an editor goes through the slush pile and the economics of publishing and how sales to bookstores work and how you can pitch to Hollywood and things like advanced level stuff, not this is what a manuscript format is and this is how to describe a scene. That's not what we're about. We're about more of the serious stuff and how to become a professional writer rather than just a published writer.
Right. It all sounds really, really good. I was reading the little blurbs on the site. Definitely, if you're serious about doing this and becoming a writer, I think that is a great, great seminar to take.
Well, and I don't want to twist anybody's arm, but the price does go up $50 at the end of the month. So if you sign up for it now, you'll get $50 off of the price.
You are also great at being on the web. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on the web?
Yeah, my website is wordfire.com, like words on fire, WORDFIRE. And you can find me on Twitter. My initial's KJA, so it's the KJA. My wife made that one up. I didn't. And
it works.
It works. That's there. So the KJA on Twitter, or I follow SF Signal, so you guys can go to their site and find me as one of the followers. I'm on Facebook, but my blog and all the connections and everything, you can just go to wordfire.com and you can hit the Facebook button there or the Twitter button and all that stuff and find me.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks again for joining us tonight, and thank your wife for letting you spend almost an hour with us.
Well, I think she'll be perfectly happy to have the concentration time to do some packing for a trip we're taking. So,
awesome.
Anyway, it was great to talk to you guys, and I hope your listeners enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
They did.
Thank you.
Thank you.